Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are once again in our very fancy and elaborate distributed semi-setup. And I feel like this is a place where we should note that none of us are sound engineers or really engineers of any kind. My ability to do math has no reflection on my ability to do things involving electronics or other devices. So
process may be our Valentine, but process is definitely not our Valentine when it comes to sound engineering and having batteries or SD cards or a charged laptop or anything like that. And I swear the people used to want to trust us all with national security secrets.
That's how you know we're not going to leak them. Because we don't know how to report that information.
Well, we know how, but we would just forget the document in our other purse in the other office on the wrong day. Yep. And so we could have a whole really bad YouTube sitcom about the machinations that go into each of these episodes. And that's even before we start drinking, which reminds me, Lauren, what are we drinking today?
Well, we are drinking, if I can pronounce this, the Allagash Curio Ale Aged in Oak Bourbon Barrels, which was a wonderful gift from a listener, Steve. Thank you so much for sending us three bottles of this. It tastes phenomenal. I may have been sampling a little bit of it before we came here. Apparently not enough to actually help with our sound engineering.
And I will see Steve O'Grady later this week up in Portland, Maine.
Nice.
So we're at Monktoberfest. It's a big data science software geek fest, and I'm very excited about all of that. So thanks to Steve and any other listeners who would like to send us booze. You're always more than welcome.
Center for New American Security always welcomes your booze packages.
That's right. That's right. Shall we dive right into keeping up foreign relations?
It feels like everyone in the world has decided to have an election or a referenda this week. And I'll be honest, I'm having a hard time keeping up.
It's like Oprah for independence. You get a referendum and you get a referendum. You get a referendum. And it's but they're not all going super great.
And also, like, does it really matter if you have a referenda and it doesn't actually do anything? Do you just feel really good about yourself, really independent?
Well, the Kurds are probably the best example of the, like, if you have a referendum in, you know, in the woods, does, you know, what happens?
You just piss a lot of people off, so far as I can tell.
It turns out there is a lot of downside to these sorts of things, right? Radha, have you been following this?
I have. So for those who don't actively track semi-independent regions in Iraq, there is a Kurdish region in the north, and they have a sort of quasi-autonomous structure. And they recently, about a week ago, we're recording this on Monday, October 2nd, had a referendum. Where they,
I don't really know what day it is.
I swear. They had a referendum to say that they wanted to secede from Iraq, which...
surprise to anyone. Of course they do. Who wouldn't?
And their goal was to use the referendum to, as a mandate for being able to peacefully negotiate secession with Baghdad. There's never any indication, mind you, that anyone was going to allow them to peacefully negotiate any kind of secession, Baghdad or any of the other neighboring countries who also have Kurdish regions who they don't want to be autonomous. So I think most recently Iran has sent some tanks up to the border there, the Kurdish border on their side, just to, you know, hang out in case anything gets a little out of hand. And that's kind of where we are. Baghdad probably doesn't want them to secede for a number of reasons, but not the least of which is oil revenue, which comes from the Kurdish region into Baghdad, or is supposed to come from the Kurdish region into Baghdad, and then a portion of it get paid back, and it's never been clear to me how much of that actually happens. So that's kind of where we are.
And that's kind of tied into some of the broader Syria policy questions, right? So there's Kurds in Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey. None of those individual Kurdish factions actually get along with each other, much less their home, you know, the national governments in most of those places. So this is...
And depending on what side of a border you're on, you may or may not be accused of being a terrorist organization, even if you're more or less the same kind of organization in the Kurdish dynamic.
Yes, you're either an American ally or a terrorist organization, depending on whether you're a PKK or YPG, right?
This is actually one dynamic that's always been interesting to me. I feel like my entire career in the defense establishment, basically everyone in the Pentagon world loves the Kurds. They love the Kurds. And I don't know if that's actually an accurate rationale for them liking their own policies or just the fact that they did their R&R up in the Kurdish areas right. for
well,
the longest time.
Well, also it's because the Kurds love us, which goes back to or many Iraqi Kurds in particular, I think fondly of the United States, which is part of Operation Provide Comfort and no-fly zones that were enforced in northern Iraq after the first Gulf War. And I mean, it's just a very... There's a long history there it's an emotional attachment on multiple sides, which is interesting.
In fairness to the Kurds, they have not been treated terribly nicely by any of the countries in which they have small amounts of territory. Now, they're also sometimes not that nice to either those countries or to the other Kurdish factions with whom they disagree. So there's a lot of infighting there. I will say they managed to do something which I myself never thought was possible, which was to get Ankara, Tehran, and Baghdad to all agree.
Right.
On something.
It's kind of amazing.
It is quite amazing. That's right. That is that they don't like this referendum.
Correct.
Right.
So, you know.
In any kind of like normal National Security Council situation, and we are clearly not in a normal one, there would be some exhausted meeting happening at some point in this referendum process where somebody says, well, why don't we just support them because we like them and these seem like good guys and I wouldn't want to be part of Iraq either. So what's y'all's perspective on that? How does that, from a U.S. policy perspective, why wouldn't we want to support a Kurdish referendum for independence?
I mean, Radha can say from her experience, which I think is much more specifically policy driven, but in general, we are not in favor of reworking too many boundaries.
Unless you're Joe Biden.
Well, right. Okay. So but the we I mean here is like the formal part of the policy apparatus. We're going to talk about Spain here in a second, and I think it applies there as well. It certainly is part of our set of policies in Africa and other parts of the world. But interestingly, it didn't super apply to Yugoslavia, though we were probably late in coming to recognizing Yugoslavian breakup and independence. But in general, I think maybe a different way to phrase this is that I think we could be talked into a process, because process is many people's Valentines, between the KRG and Baghdad, right? Between the Kurds and the Iraqi National Government. If the Iraqi National Government said, we're willing to renegotiate this and we want to have a UN-sponsored set of talks about establishing Kurdistan, that's something that I think that we would not thwart necessarily.
Correct. So I think the way to think about this is, generally, we don't want to redraw borders, and we don't, in particular, want to take sides on internal conflicts on border lines. Now, in rare cases, Sudan and South Sudan being like the notable example, if there is an external, what we consider valid, sort of internationally compliant process, we can kind of go through and support that. And that's not the end of the world. And we have seen this in places, Ethiopia and Eritrea, Sudan and South Sudan. But generally, no, we don't want to do it. And in particular, the Kurdish region is really tense. And because a number of our allies, like Turkey, who we really need to work with us on things
like
Syria.
But like it's a total
Syria,
frenemy at the moment. I mean, and for the last 10 years, maybe, right?
But like everyone
like
is
the
our
Taylor
frenemy
Swift.
Right now.
It's like the Taylor Swift of allies.
But she's still in our crew.
True.
Right?
Yep. Squad.
So we have that. And we certainly are not enthused about the idea of Iran trying to exert influence into a Kurdish region absent us, especially as Aaron noted, we have this long sort of history. So I think we generally don't want to encourage secessionism because we worry about devolutions and internal conflicts and that generating instability. In the Kurdish case, we especially don't want to do it. We're in a little bit of a tough spot because we do have these Kurdish Iraqi militia that we are using in some cases in Syria, deployed in as partners. So I think we all would have preferred there not to be a referendum and for this referendum to now just be a signal that we should all be nicer to the Kurds, but nobody moves the lines.
Right. It's like when you have it's like when you have a fight with your spouse and you say, like, I'm just going to go have dinner by myself. And it's not that you actually want to break up with them. You just want to signal that, like, maybe you should be nicer to me. I've never done that.
So the Kurds weren't the only ones who had a referendum this last week. In fact, the Catalan region of Spain also had a referendum, which has a very different geopolitical context, a very different local context. The history of Catalonia and Barcelona in particular was a Republican stronghold during the Spanish Civil War. Catalan language was banned under the Franco regime, which is in living memory of a great many Spaniards. But the referendum itself was fairly contested or was not uniformly popular, even in Catalonia. I think I heard that turnout was only about 50%. Folks who opposed independence for Catalonia boycotted the referendum. And as a result, 90% of those who voted did support independence, which is the one challenge with the strategy of boycotting and whatnot. All of that would have been reasonably newsworthy, I think. But it was the reaction of the Spanish government and of the civil guard that got headlines over the weekend. There was a fairly violent crackdown on voters. There were pretty pronounced, and the social media images that were coming across were pretty intense. And this is in a EU member state, a democracy that, you know, you wouldn't expect to see violence from the state against voters in 2017 necessarily. Right. And that's maybe catalyzed the pro-independence folks or pushed folks who were on the fence or kind of leaning against to say, well, you know, I didn't really have a strong opinion before, but now I'm feeling much more antagonistic toward Madrid and much more in support of some sort of secession or independence movement.
Yeah, we had a friend who said, and I'm going to misquote him badly, that, you know, if Spain really wanted to do everything possible to set up violent separatist movements within its own borders, it's kind of checking a lot of those boxes pretty effectively right now. So more power to you. I guess I'm going to write a case study.
And to be fair, this is not the first violent separatist movement within the Spanish borders, right? Tierra Basco, you know, ETA in Spain has had a long-running violent campaign for Basque secession for at least 30-plus years. Folks who work with kind of political science conflict data sets will recognize, you know, ETA as the other terror group that makes it into the Civil War data sets, along with the IRA, partially it's just a long-running campaign. So there are... you know, Spain is probably less monolithic and less integrated than most Americans would recognize. There's a lot of variation, language and otherwise there. But this is sort of a new fork in the road.
Yeah, it's a weird one, too, because I think, you know, in some ways, the Spanish Supreme Court did rule the referendum illegal or unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And so the government would have had some legitimacy in completely and totally ignoring this,
right?
Saying like, these are not votes, like these don't count as anything, this is not a legitimate election.
It's basically an online poll, right? It's just
right.
Like
it's just right. There. And so it's like a fascinating choice to deploy not just police but really sort of proactive, you know, bust up ballot boxes, commit some, at least what looks like on social media, pretty serious violence, and then you know, say, well, but these guys were breaking the rules by what, conducting an illegal vote? Like it mm-hmm. sort of lacks the feel of it. And I know that there was some talk about filing complaints with the EU, so it'll be interesting to see sort of in this world of, are we worried about right wing movements? What do we think about these sort of fascist groups that have quote unquote fascist groups or right wing extremist groups that are sort of gaining influence? What do we think of the change in government strategies to deal with elections with that they think are illegitimate? And that's going to be something that Europe needs to start grappling with.
Some of the initial responses I saw from the EU, and these were again like extremely preliminary, I think before a lot of the news of violence came out, were somewhat disappointing in that they were talking about this is an internal Spanish matter that they should deal with within their own borders. And that just sounds very, very both emblematic of past problems that we have seen in this space, but also just really problematic in terms of how you condemn both the Spanish actions, but also think of a good way forward in terms of some of these independence movements.
And what's interesting on the EU front is that there was a time, and it's been a while maybe, that EU integration was seen as a path forward for dealing with a lot of what be called center periphery issues within European states or certainly within sort of regional dynamics, right? So you know, the EU integration for the UK, interestingly, was really important for kind of buying off both Scotland and Northern Ireland, right? It sort of reduces down the importance of the national government and gives you an extra systemic place to appeal for resources and rights and other kinds of things. And so, you know, the UK, Spain, again, both Tirabasco and Catalonia, other regions in Italy that had kind of other nationalist or regional aspirations. The EU at the time, this would have been maybe the late 90s, early 2000s, because it had this extra governmental, this supra governmental structure, you didn't have to care quite so much about what's happening in Rome or London or Paris. You could appeal to Brussels and to this broader European identity. So you could be a Catalan and a European. You know, you could be a Scot and a European. You didn't have to worry about the national identity. And I think part of this, a little bit of what we're seeing, is also some of the challenges the EU has had of maintaining the centripetal force of EU integration, whether it's from the Greek financial crisis, certainly from Brexit and the follow-on, there's some direct follow-on pieces for Northern Ireland and maybe even Scotland. And that seems, I could certainly tell a story about how that's playing out in Spain as well. So these are pretty complicated stories on the European side. And we have one more European story to tell, I think, this week, which is just the follow-up to our last episode on the German elections. So Angela Merkel won. She will continue to be the Bundeskanzler in Germany. She'll continue to be the chancellor. But the right-wing party, the AfD, also did quite well. And so maintains some of the challenges that we've seen on populism and right-wing parties in Europe more broadly. So I don't know if you have more to say on that, but that's the kind of coda.
You know, I think Merkel kind of took it in the chin here with some of what I think were pretty humane policies on things like refugees and jobs, and she just kind of accepted that
she just
that
was
going to... Yeah. And I mean, there's something to be said about that, but I don't think the electoral impact was super surprising or told us a lot of new information about Germany for now. It will be interesting to see if that changes how she feels she needs to behave for domestic political reasons going forward, though it does seem like sort of pushing back on some American behavior does buy her space, even with this German populace. So there's something to that.
So Julie Smith, who has been a guest on our show before, had a really great piece in Foreign Policy on the German election earlier this week, or last week. What day is it exactly?
Still recently, Monday.
She wrote about the German election, and she made a few key points in there that anyone who has gone on a trip to Europe recently from the United States has heard at every conference. Well, after the election, Angela will be able to do this, or after the election, Germany will be able to take a leading role in this horrifically challenging policy issue or EU issue. And Julie's point was basically that after this election, actually, her role has not gotten any easier. The coalition that she will have to build to maintain power is going to be that much more difficult because the SPD, the Socialist Democratic Party, not socialist, very different.
Well, it's just the center-left party in Germany.
Center-left party in Germany has decided to go into the opposition as opposed to be part of a broader coalition. The extreme far-right party has gained an official and prominent voice in German politics, which she's going to have to contend with and see, is this just sort of a one-off thing responding to the issues that Radha mentioned, or is this going to be an increasingly tense dynamic in German politics? And I just think more broadly, I think people are going to be not necessarily disappointed, but they're going to have to wait for a change, as Radha pointed out, in how Merkel is handling a lot of her both EU political issues as well as her domestic ones.
So we'll keep an eye on all of those exciting trends. Which of you ladies like to kick us off through White House mayhem?
Well, I think that many of us have had a moment in our lives where we just said, Chad. Everybody knows a Chad. They just do. I feel like this is just like a prominent part of people who grew up in the 90s. They know a Chad and they probably have.
And they always wear loafers without socks.
Yep. And they you have to just like have this exclamation about them, which was very common, very similar to how most people reacted to the Trump administration's new release of their travel ban, where they updated who was in, who was out, and who was in. That surprised us all was Chad. Why was Chad part of the travel ban? Does anybody know?
I don't think we have a good answer.
I think
right?
The things that we do know is that DOD, or at least according to New York Times and foreign policy reports, Department of Defense and Department of State didn't really want Chad to be in the travel ban because they have been an increasingly more effective partner to us on counterterrorism issues. There's more cooperation to be done with them. They're, you know, they're not perfect, but they're certainly have been guided along a path of being a closer United States partner on a number of security issues.
And they're definitely not a net exporter of terrorism or...
Certainly compared to like our good friends, the Saudis.
Or Pakistan, who are also not on the list.
Right.
So, yes, this...
Yeah, so the claim on this, which is, you know, there, we have no way to verify, is that they went through the countries for which we would need information to conduct proper background checks on people, and Chad fell in this bucket, and when they can more appropriately information share that background information and track the people, then they can get off the travel ban. I think more likely they needed a country that didn't make it look like they were just doing the same thing for the third time, and Chad drew the short straw.
I mean, because I could believe some story. If you wanted to tell me that Chad had poor legibility, that it had not great documentation on each and every one of its citizens, I would believe that story. The problem is that I do not believe that Sudan doesn't have the same problem, much less southern Sudan, which, as we noted before, is a relatively new state. And the flip side of which is I don't believe that's a problem North Korea has, which is also a state on the list, right? So the idea that we have, you know, documentation shortfalls as the clear and convincing Weberian expectation for, you know, being on this list just doesn't quite meet the smell test slash laugh in your face test.
It feels very fascist to let this focus on documents rather than strategy. And the what's more interesting to me out of this is like the, was there, dare I say, an interagency process in which DOD and state were able to voice concerns to be like, whoa, hold up, you throw them on the list, you throw away years of work that we have done to kind of gently and slowly bring them more on side in our counterterrorism efforts. I kind of doubt it, but, you know, process is decidedly not this administration's Valentine. So, you know, the comparison doesn't necessarily hold.
So speaking of another issue of getting some folks on the same page, and coordinating a policy response. Did you guys see the tweets from President Trump with regard to Secretary Tillerson's efforts in East Asia?
Yeah, Rexy baby, don't worry. It's fine. We got it. We got other options. You just go rest.
Don't waste your time. I mean, like that, like who says that? Like, how do you tell your Secretary of State?
Secretary of State.
Not to waste their time trying to avert nuclear war.
On diplomacy, obviously that's not his job, Aaron.
Right. What's great, it was already kind of a big thing for Tillerson to make some of his remarks about our discussions directly with the North Koreans. So that should have been an actual and bigger story unto itself. But instead, we are more focused on the just go relax. Don't worry about it. I got this.
I mean, you're right. It was an interesting story. Tillerson was in the region. He was in Beijing. He had made some comments about having some open channels with the North Koreans. People were trying to parse out what it, you know, were we talking about the New York channels? Was there something else that had opened? Were we talking about pre-existing questions about American citizens? Were we actually talking about nuclear weapons and, you know, current crisis de-escalation? You know, that all was like a substantive conversation that we were trying to figure out kind of in real time how our North Korea policy was evolving, which was, of course, once again, short-circuited by some freaking tweets. To indicate, you know, Rexy baby, we're good. Like, you know, go to the bar, now, like, get a drink.
I will say, in the vein of tweets and this all whole fun back and forth that we've had between our beloved dear leader and the other dear leader, that the number of times at which one of them has said, like, well, that is an act of war over the last several months. I apparently don't have a very good understanding of what acts of war are anymore, because they've been declaring it quite often and not necessarily doing a lot of follow-up, which is probably better for humanity overall, but has caused me to probably inappropriately write off some of the escalation that's going on both on the North Korean side as well as on the U.S. side.
Yeah, the North Koreans have a habit of this. They've labeled apparently lots of things an act of war over the years, but we do seem to be in this weird quote unquote war of words that I don't know where exactly it goes. So
the commentary at all reacted by saying, well, you know, if Rex had any respect for himself, he will be resigning in the morning. I'm like, which member of this cabinet wakes up and think, gosh, I would really love to resign, but I'm not going to because of whatever. Like, they've all clearly had these moments 39 times over the past week or so. What that we think that this one moment of policy is going to be their last straw is kind of fascinating about what we think actually impacts their decision making or not.
This weekend on Saturday Night Live, there was a skit with Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions, and I believe Jeff Sessions' character summed it up with don't tweet on me. Please don't tweet on me.
Look at Rada with the pop culture knowledge.
Oh my gosh.
Look. I watched it like 3 hours earlier here now, so it's really great. Saturday Night Live at 9 o'clock on Saturday before my bedtime. But I think this is it. Like, the whatever deal they've made with themselves, these cabinet officials have decided that they're better off in than out. And, you know, they, in Tillerson's defense, he's trucking on with his trying to at least make some kind of progress on North Korea. And frankly, somebody needs to try to do that. So might as well be the Secretary of State.
Yeah, I don't see any of them resigning anytime soon. I mean, that ship has sailed. Maybe you can get fired if you take private planes places.
That's
apparently
true.
We've established that's a thing. We'll see.
Depends on the person. We'll see right. What happens.
We'll see how it goes.
That's right. Or Scott Pruitt.
If you take Air Force One to go golfing every weekend, that's totally cool. Don't worry about that.
Totally fine.
I will say, Mil Air, certain kinds of military air is some of the best airline experience I've ever had in my life. So I can understand why they want to pursue this.
Totally.
Rada, do you want to talk about the new counterterrorism rules?
Sure. I would love to talk about the counterterrorism rules.
So are they actually rules yet, or are we just sort of like dealing with some rumors?
Yeah. So I think they're somewhere in between rumors and rules. they seem to be like written down and going through some kind of review process. So thumbs up for that. I don't fully understand what the review process entails, and in particular, what the legal side versus the policy side of that review process is. So for those just joining us and haven't heard me pontificate on counterterrorism processes and rules, let
me
just...
We should just kill people. We know.
But you know, in 2013, the then president made a bunch of rules in his speech at NDU, President Obama, and those rules set up a bunch of things. So one is they separated war zones and non-war zones. And in war zones, there were different standards, in particular for civilian targeted, for civilian casualties, for strikes and operations. Two, they defined this sort of process of coming up with who you could target. So they had to be high value targets. They had to be in groups that we designated through this authorization of use of military force, which is old, and there's a lot of debate about whether it should be updated. And then they had to be reviewed through this principals, deputies process, depending on the target, whether what the civilian casualties were, and frankly, whether there were American citizens. Should also note that it tried to end sort of or remove military operations from covert action. So there were, as disclosed by the president in 2013, covert action programs that overlapped with military programs. And there was a discussion of changing that so that everything fell under standard Title 10 military authorities.
Okay, too long, didn't read. What's the new stuff? What happened?
Let's delegate.
Let's delegate. So DoD gets to decide who they want to target and when they want to target and what they want to target. And much like the Oprah of referendums, it's also the Oprah of counterterrorism strikes. DOD, you get a strike. CIA, you get a strike. Everyone gets to strike who they want. It's great. Nothing could go wrong with this.
Yeah,
also, not clear the legal standards or review process to make sure these don't, you know, like violate, I don't know, current domestic or international law. So it should be fun for us to see.
Oh, come on. No, I will give one positive aspect I read about these policies, which was the requirement to come forward with basically a country strategy, country plan with regard to counterterrorism for any country within which DOD or I guess CIA, and they're not really clear on within the context of this leak, is taking a strike, which is kind of better than the one-off version that we've had over the last few years, where things are debated incredibly intensively at the deputies principals level from target to target, but not necessarily on the broader country strategy writ large. I think
which is handled at the embassies.
What's that?
Which is handled at the embassies.
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by country strategy. But like but I guess the point being, like, we spend a whole lot of time providing very crucial moral discussion over whether or not this is an actual target or not, whether or not they fall into a variety of definitions that are really important, but don't necessarily think kind of beyond our line of sight of like, so what do we do next? What happens after that? What are the risks that we're entailing based on our drone strategy? On this, Rada May.
What we do next is we kill another guy.
We kill another guy. And you know what? It's remarkable.
Such a great strategy, Rada.
There is always another guy to kill.
Yeah. That's the plan.
We're feeling punchy today on Bombshell.
I think we have to see kind of where this evolves. Look, in some ways, it's heartening to see that this administration is trying to come up with a CT process, even if it differs from the last administration's process. And it'll be interesting, frankly, to see what things they keep. It looks like they're going to keep this war zone, non-war zone distinction, which would be nice because it's the thing that generates civilian protection. So it's not all bad news. And the New York Times article certainly had a shocking amount of information on the process as it's going, which is not ideal. But, you know, we'll see both what this ends up and how transparent this administration wants to be on what that process looks like.
I mean, all these questions sort of come down to, and, you know, and the social scientist in me finds this fascinating. If you let the DOD regulate itself, what would it do? And
remember, DOD lawyers are the ones who approve napalm.
Yeah. I mean, they approve lots of things. There's lots of complicated and not so complicated institutional incentives from various services, from various, you know, sub components. And, you know, there's it's still possible within DOD institutions to have civilian control. Obviously, the Office of Secretary of Defense is a civilian run organization, more or less. But it begs a lot of really interesting organizational questions and some, you know, not to mention interagency or other, you know, kind of balance kinds of questions. So we're getting of the many live experiments we're running in this administration, this is, I think, one of them. And we'll see where if the Defense Department likes the outcome.
A subcomponent of this experiment that we're running that I will flag for a later discussion is, do you have civilian control if the vast majority of your civilian leaders are veterans?
It's a good question.
I don't know. We'll solve it later.
We'll solve it later. Probably with a little bit stronger beverages. Not barrel age, but just some straight up bourbon. Anything else for White House mayhem, or shall we shift into what's next?
What is next? So I think two things that we are all looking at what's next is, when all of us woke up this morning, at least in my case, we learned about the horrible news about the attacks in Las Vegas, where at last count, nearly 100 people had died and close to 500 had been injured. One of the most catastrophic attacks in American history on domestic soil. And there's still questions about what are the shooter's motives? How did he manage to accumulate all these weapons in a hotel room that presumably had housekeeping staff going in and out? And 30,000 other questions that I'm sure will come up and we will sort of ineffectually debate without actually doing anything, but I won't betray my bias there. But what's the, in terms of U.S. policy response, what are the key issues we should be focused on Las Vegas?
Well, so one thing is, of course, ISIS, for reasons that are not at all clear to me, has claimed credit for this attack. It's an interesting turn of events in two dimensions. One, because we don't know how ISIS would be connected to this particular shooter. There's no evidence, there's no history, there's no background there. But two, this kind of opens up this wider discussion on, look, ISIS has been trying to establish continued relevance and the standards by which they claim attacks hasn't necessarily been the same as we've seen in past terrorist groups. So we'll kind of have to see that shake out and see what it means also for someone to be connected to, inspired, or for a group to take in some way credit, and what we think about that for U.S. policies. and responses.
I was listening to a story on this attack talking about whether or not it was quote unquote terrorism. And I have some weird analytical perspectives on what we should or should not call terrorism. But from a matter of federal law requires terrorism to be linked to a designated terrorist organization, a foreign terrorist group. And so we, as a matter of federal law, don't really have a statute for domestic terrorism. So an individual could be charged with mass murder, which I think is probably what happened in the Oklahoma City bombings. There's conspiracy charges and other kinds of things, but we don't have domestic terrorism statutes in the same way that we do for foreign terrorism. And so that partially drives some of this debate around how we label activities as terrorism or not. You know, all that said, there seems to be a trend toward the only terrorism is terrorism that's linked to Al-Qaeda or ISIS or some other jihadi, you know, networked organization. And I think that that's a real analytical flaw for us to fall into. There's lots of ways for groups, foreign and domestic, to, you know, use violence against civilians for political purposes, which is really how I think of terrorism. And, you know, this is part of that broader debate. So what else is next? Puerto Rico?
Yeah.
Ongoing?
I think Puerto Rico is going to require us to have, I think, continued focus over the next several months. I think people have been extremely focused on a number of somewhat tactical issues about like whether or not the USNS Comfort is on its way. It's a hospital ship run by the Navy. How many DOD assets are supporting in Puerto Rico? I think regardless of those, whether or not they're there or not issues, that the U.S. government response to Puerto Rico has been pretty delayed. But with all that said, I'm not excusing the president and his administration. This shit's complicated. This is going to be hard, and it's going to take a lot longer than the next couple weeks, and it means a lot more than whether or not you have a hospital ship on site.
Marco Rubio had some good comments on this over the weekend, which was to the point of part of the challenge is that the government of Puerto Rico has been just as affected as all the citizens of Puerto Rico. So their ability to request aid, to request, you know, lifting of the Jones Act, which has implications for foreign ships being in port and all these other things. They literally haven't had phone connectivity. They also don't have electricity.
Yep.
And this gets to the resilience of a lot of government systems, but the way in which everybody rides on the same commercial networks, whether for communications or electricity or water or whatnot. And, you know, that's part of the challenge. Again, I think we have a natural experiment with Haiti. We can compare response times between this hurricane in Puerto Rico this year and the Haiti earthquake a few years ago. And yeah, timeline wise, this current response does not stack up super great. But part of it is also just the nature of the crisis locally in San Juan and elsewhere.
And just to put a finer point on that and kind of close this out, I think, you know, when you think about mobilizing in places like Texas or Florida, where there were big parts of the state that weren't affected, things like mobilizing your state National Guard, which the governor can
exactly
do, worked really quickly and effectively in a way that it just literally couldn't in Puerto Rico, because not only is the government affected, but all of those guardsmen are affected and not able to get communication, mobilize, muster, et cetera. So I think we're seeing that sort of issue play out in a lot of dimensions for local forces in Puerto Rico that could have been the sort of more quick initial response. And hopefully, as things get rolling now, we'll see a little bit of speeding up of the pace of response.
Anything else coming up next? I'm really excited to learn who the next head coach of the Louisville men's basketball team is going to be, which is a scandal that I'm sure none of you are following, but has...
Where, what?
Uh-huh.
What, Ben's back? Oh, the basketball.
Basketball.
Sports ball.
Sports ball.
Okay.
The FBI has been tapping the phones of a number of assistant basketball coaches and others around the country for years. It's an excellent use of taxpayer money. We should just pay players. Anywho, that's been very big in the Simpson family this week.
I have had one area of emphasis for looking at sports in the last week, and that was football, which, to be clear, I'm protesting having to care about football. I grew up in Texas, and I'm done. So, sorry, I have not absorbed your basketball stories at this point in time. I'm sure they're very critical to a large number of you.
We'll get to more of those. Pop culture?
So I think Ken Burns is trying to kill me.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, right? Like, it's important.
Yes. Sorry. Yes. Gosh, that was terrible of me. I think Ken Burns and Lynn Novick are trying to kill me.
So I assume many of our listeners have watched some number of episodes of the Vietnam documentary. We are all kind of, I think, in different phases of it. And it is like 8 stages of grief as you go through the different episodes.
It's so hard.
And it, I don't.
What I can't tell is it hard? Are they doing it this way on purpose? Or have they found things that they know are going to resonate? Or is it just,
I don't think so.
We're just that stupid.
A different answer to that question is we are bringing our own experiences to their documentary.
Yeah.
And also, yes, we are that stupid. We've made exactly the same mistakes.
Just to be clear about what we're talking about, I think that anyone who worked on Afghanistan, certainly, but also Iraq issues in the aughts and the teens of this millennia, are watching this Vietnam documentary and thinking, wow, this was written for me in order to punch me in the stomach nightly for the next couple of weeks, and I'm just going to suffer through it, apparently.
There's one episode, there's a character, a woman they interview several times. She's a South Vietnamese woman, and her father was a South Vietnamese government official. And it turns out she worked for the Hamlet Evaluation Survey, which was a very famous set of surveys done by the Defense Department, but actually implemented by the RAND Corporation, and provides some of the best and most amazing data on the war and kind of what local control looks like and was pacification working or not, and is a great example of how you can both ask all the wrong questions or ask all the right questions, but ask too many of them and never actually analyze the data in time. And I remember looking at her and listening to her description of the interviews she was doing in prison. She was interviewing Viet Cong prisoners in South Vietnam who'd been captured, and thinking, I would have worked for Bob McNamara. I mean, how many campaign assessments did I do in Afghanistan? I mean, for how many different organizations? I did them for DOD, I did them for USAID, I did them for the Army. Like, and so that kind of ruined my weekend, I'm not going to lie. I had a pretty big existential crisis over not just my role in the run-up to Afghanistan, but also, you know, what I would have done in the 60s. We all owe it to ourselves to watch this documentary and reflect a little bit.
I totally agree. And it's like a really meet your maker kind of moment when you realize that you would definitely have designed not only the questions, but the after analysis spin consistent with the government continuing to do things, because that seemed in the snapshot of time you were in, like it was a good idea. When looking back, you're like, wow, it was a terrible idea. And no amount of data was ever going to make it a good idea. And there were no questions to ask to make this make sense. And the many tweaks you make on these questions are not a big deal. It's a real, I agree. I think if you worked on any part of this and you thought we were smarter or learning lessons or a learning organization, it's a humbling emotional experience. I recommend you pace yourself on them.
Yeah, it's hard to binge. I can't watch more than one episode at a time.
I agree. And I need a day or so. I need a little space between them where you end up like crumpled in a ball on the floor.
But I also really want my parents to watch it. And I want other people to watch it. I want to hear about their reactions to it. Because we each had individual roles, both in the run-up, and obviously Radha and I were both in country at one point. But different people are going to bring different things, you know, to this. And I hope people take a chance to watch it, because it's a pretty powerful set of images and interviews. And it's very thorough with lots of Americans, but North and South Vietnamese, and trying to bring lots of different things to the table in that conversation.
Yeah.
I think it's actually really decent and humane to all the cast of characters who are incredibly flawed, in a way that like does not in any way let them off the hook, but also at the same time shows you the path that they were led down of like, I feel like I have to be in this incredibly awful position to make this decision that is terrible. And I fully recognize how terrible it is. In some ways that were, I think, honestly more prescient than in Afghanistan in a lot of ways. That they were very conscious of like, this is bad and I feel like I have to do it.
I think it's a little sympathetic to McNamara, who had a lot of private doubts that he was unwilling to actually act on. And or you know, they were in private memos to the president, but they weren't in any public statements.
I cannot out this official, but there in the Obama administration, there was an official that sent a number of private memos to him over and over again about certain policies and was so frustrated that these made no difference, but was unwilling to voice these opinions in front of a larger group of people. And if I could go back and like throttle anyone in the Obama administration, it would be that official.
It's a tough, I mean, if only there were a book we could read about what national security staff and senior military officials should do when they feel confronted with such things.
Wow, I really wish it was there.
We'll leave that as an exercise for the reader. On a slightly cheerier note, I saw The Kingsman, which was nowhere, the sequel, which is nowhere as good as the first movie, but is a perfectly good spy romp if you're into weird British sorts of spy novels sorts of things.
Also, if you're looking for your counter to watching the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary, you should think about watching The Good Place, which
I just started that
and is hilarious and will allow you to escape from reality into a made up world of heaven and hell. So there you go.
It's good. Also, Poldark is back.
Poldark is back.
Yeah, Poldark is back.
We're definitely the target demographic for Poldark. Our listeners might not be, but us three hosts are definitely where that's at. So
it's like historical and you know, he fought in the American Revolution, so that counts.
Okay. Super Rada. Perfect. He was a British officer in that revolution, just in case anybody was wondering. And it's also not why any of us are watching.
No.
No.
But it, yeah.
Good deal.
We'll just leave it there.
We'll leave it there. All right, ladies.
On that happy
else?
Note, we will talk to you all in a couple of weeks with different sound engineering issues and maybe harder alcohol.